listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. Not too much solar power going on today.
Not much. rain.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. And don't forget that if you can't listen to all of today's program, or you want to hear it again, or you want to tell your friends about it, we rebroadcast on Monday morning.
Right. We're broadcasting live 1 Central Friday, rebroadcasting live 8 a.m. And we also have the website, writersvoices.com, where eventually we will post the interviews. I'm a little behind. I'm trying to get caught up there. So what do we have today, Mom?
Well, today we have an interesting book, and it's by Jonathan Lethem. And he is a New York Times best-selling author of 10 novels. Very prolific gentleman. Maybe our listeners have read some of these. A Gambler's Anatomy, A Dissident Gardens, Chronic City, The Fortress of Solitude, and Motherless Brooklyn. And he's also a head work appear in New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, Rolling Stone, Esquire, and the New York Times. So it's quite a variety of appeals there, I would say.
And the book we have today is a book of essays on books and writing called,
yes,
More Alive and Less Lonely on Books and Writers by Jonathan Lethem, edited and with an introduction by Christopher Boucher.
Boucher is how his name is said.
Okay. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Jonathan.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with kind of the most obvious question. Why did you become a writer?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, this book is, in a way, a testament to it. It was my appetite for books. My love of reading fed directly into that desire to enter the world of books in a way, you know, I was participating in a conversation that enthralled me as a reader, and I wanted to talk back to it. I wanted to enter into it and make my own voice a part of it.
So was that something that you knew from a very young age that you wanted to do?
Yeah, I began to sense it pretty early on. I was, I had a good head start, in a sense. I was lucky in that my family was an artistic one. My father is still a painter, and my mother was a great reader, and our home was full of books and art and music, and so I was nourished by this stuff. I took it for granted as a kind of part of life that that was available to me, and seeing my father go up into a studio every day and make paintings meant that the idea of making some kind of art wasn't exotic to me. It seemed like, oh yeah, okay, people do this, and I could be one of them. Why not? So what took me a little while to do was to settle on writing fiction specifically. I painted and I drew because of my father, and I also wanted to make films for a while, and I thought I would make comic books at one point. And then eventually I settled, I think, when I was about 13, 14, I suddenly began to really focus on...
Eventually at 13.
Well, for me, I felt like it was an evolution, and it was when I was 15 that I began really trying to write fiction, and I never really stopped after that.
Wow.
So when did you start with short stories, or did you dive right into novels?
Well, I think, actually, I wrote... When I was 15, my mother gave me a manual typewriter, little black metal manual typewriter. And on my summer vacation when I was 15, I wrote what I called a novel. It was about 125 pages. And, you know, I was very impressed with it. I mean, enough or good enough to matter, but it was my start. And so I actually did begin as a novelist first. And then all through high school I wrote short stories.
Wow. And what was your road to publishing like? Was it easy or was it a little rocky?
Well, rocky would be exaggerating it, because I really, in the end, it all worked out beautifully and didn't take me that long, although at the time it felt like an eternity. I was writing, I began another novel when I was in college, when I was 19, and that interested me a great deal more than college, and so I kind of dropped out to write and began thinking of myself as working exclusively towards publication around that time. But I did, my first novel wasn't published until I was 30. So there was a long road in a way through my 20s, but I had to learn to write. I just, you know, I had a lot of bad pages to put behind me before the adequate ones began to appear. And in those years, in my middle 20s, I published a few short stories. I mean, I found some encouragement. I wasn't completely working in isolation, in the dark. But I didn't see my first book come out until I was 30 years old, by which time I felt like an old man.
And now when you see a 30-year-old, what do you think?
I think that's fine. That's a perfectly good time to get started. I mean, you know, I knew some prodigies. I happened to go to college with some people who published when we were all very young, and so I had this exaggerated standard that you should book in your early 20s. Well, you know, it can be done, and there are some good ones, some books I like written by people in their 20s, but on the whole, it's a art form that isn't made up of, you know, prodigies the way, say, like a Mozart or you know, or you would think of a math or science prodigy. It usually takes some seasoning for people to become interesting enough to write books that that you'd want to read, and that was true for me.
Did you ever consider giving up? I mean, 10 years of trying to be a full-time writer is...
Yeah, it would seem like I was out on a limb, but I, you know, honestly, I never did consider giving up. I had some kind of spark of vanity or willfulness, some combination of vanity and willfulness that just made me certain that this was what I was going to do and that I just had to basically shake the world by the collar until they noticed and agreed that it was, you know, time to make room for my books on the shelf.
And how did you keep a roof over your head during that time?
Well, I was a bookseller, and this really, to the contents of this collection, More Alive and Less Lonely, because I worked in used bookstores, and then in a couple of them that had new and remaindered books as well. But my real devotion was to older books, out-of-print books, antiquarian books, and this book, in a way, isn't so different from being a bookseller. It's full of my enthusiasms. It's full of, you know, I mean, there's a few very famous writers, canonical writers like Kafka and Dickens that I'm talking about in here, and there are some contemporary writers, Laurie Moore and Ian McEwan, people who were, you know, brand new and quite famous, and I reviewed their books. But the heart of this activity is me introducing obscurities, books that are forgotten or being reintroduced, republished, and I've been asked to write an introduction or an appreciation for them. And that really is sort of like what I was doing working in used bookstores, you know, finding the value in books that weren't brand new.
Oh, interesting. So we noticed reading through this book that a lot of them were books that we were not familiar with, and Mom and I, and so we were talking at, before the show. It's like, well, I guess we're not as well-read as we thought we were.
Well, there's different ways of being well-read. Of course, you guys have a gigantic canon of your own favorites, and that's great. This is a canon of my favorites, and some of them are pretty unusual and obscure, but, you know, I hope that... my enthusiasm for them is infectious rather than forbidding or suggesting some sort of obligation or homework to you. It should be, you know, I've always felt there are really more marvelous books, more worthwhile books than anyone could possibly read in a lifetime.
And oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. One has to just carve out your own path through this incredible wealth, this sort of ocean of possible, possible things you could read, and just devote yourself to what you care about and what you particularly find interesting in it. You know, the truth is, if you showed me your shelf of favorites, I'd probably be equally intimidated and spot all kinds of things that I've you know, never gotten to, or maybe some that I'd never even heard of. But that's good. That describes, you know, in my mind, that describes what's great about the world of literature, is that there's so damn much of it.
Oh, absolutely. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jonathan Lethem, author of More Alive and Less Lonely on Books and Writers, edited and with an introduction by Christopher Boucher. Now, the novels that you've written, there's been 10 of them?
I've written 10 novels, yeah.
And would you say that they fit in a specific genre?
You know, many of them participate in genres and move in for a stay, like I'm visiting different genres, and then I often go running in the opposite direction and do something. So I've written crime novels, and I've written academic satire, and I've written science fiction or kind of fantastical fables. I've written family sagas at this point. I mean, you know, there are some genres I still haven't managed to get involved in, but I would say that on the...
No romance novels yet.
I haven't... Well, you know, I have love stories. I don't know that a romance practitioner, someone who really cared about the form of the typical romance novel, would think that I'd ever really been obedient to that form. But, but you know, I've been very... I guess you could say kind of promiscuous in my relationship to genre. I like a lot of them, and I find that they give a lot of energy to what I'm writing.
And the books that you write about in More Alive and Less Lonely also cover a pretty wide array of genres.
Yeah, there's everything in here for sure. There are science fiction novels, and there are, you know, well, as I said, there are great canonical writers like Dickens, and there's appreciations of you know, of nonfiction in here as well, and even of art books and photo books. There's an essay about a children's book that I loved, and you know, so nearly everything is given some, you know, among my many enthusiasms, there's evidence of my excitement about film and what else. I think I've written about comic books in here a little bit.
Wow. And even children's books.
Yes, the first essay in the book is something called The Loneliest Book I've Read, which describes my relationship to this very odd, sort of obscure children's book that was out of print, but it was given to me as a child, and I read it over and over and over again, and sort of memorized it, and so it's my testament to this. This very peculiar book.
And the title of the book, I believe, was Happy Valley.
Happy Valley, right.
And is it still out of print, or you
I
know?
I think it's still out of print. Yeah, I don't think I've managed. My enthusiasm has managed to drag this particular item back in, but you know, it's okay. There are books that belong only to one reader out there. This may be a case of that.
Wow. Do you still have that book?
I do. I can see it from where I'm sitting.
Have you read it to your... I understand you have children now.
I do have kids. You know, I haven't tried it out on them. I should do that, actually.
Well,
that's
yeah,
a
you
suggestion.
Should.
These guys, my boys are kind of not to brag about it. It's actually kind of surprising to me how much they've vaulted past picture books, how quickly they've vaulted past picture books into wanting to hear these long, you know... fantasy trilogies and series, you know, I think they're of the Harry Potter generation, and so we've gone through a lot of long stories like that. We read the Philip Pullman trilogy recently, and they're currently listening to The Neverending Story by Michael Ende.
That's a good one.
Now, I have a note, Jonathan, that that Christopher Boucher selected the essays for this
book. Right, this is very much a book of my writing, and it's created by another author. He did all the selections, and he wrote the introduction that contextualizes the book, and he is the one who came up with the title of the book. It was a phrase that was sitting inside one of my essays, but I would never have necessarily spotted it or picked it out as a possible title. So it's very much got his caretaking, scrupulous, very, very devoted hand you know, all over it, and in a way that makes the book a kind of collaboration between myself and Chris.
And why did he choose them rather than you do it yourself?
Well, you know, some of that is circumstance. I have two previous gatherings of my essays, I worked very hard on each of those books. The earliest is called The Disappointment Artist, and the second is called The Ecstasy of Influence. And they were pretty mammoth undertakings for me, and when I finished with the second of them, I sort of vowed, never again. I wanted to my novel writing. And yet there were a very large number of interesting nonfiction pieces that remained uncollected. And actually, a lot of the stuff I'd excluded had to do with books and writers. And so that sort of suggested that there was the shape of a possible book there. But I didn't want to be the one to put it together. And when I talked to Melville House and they suggested that there might be a book of my writings on writers, I said, "Yeah, probably there is, but I don't want to do it. I want it to just exist." And then they introduced me to this younger writer, this very talented young novelist, Chris Boucher, who was kind enough to take on the project and read through all this stuff and inject some order into it, you know, and help me see which of the pieces were really worth preserving in hardcovers. Because, you know, not every instance of a essay or a book review that you write is necessarily going to hold up. It might be fine for the moment, you know, in the magazine or newspaper or anthology where it first appears, but that doesn't mean it necessarily belongs in hardcovers on the permanent shelf. So Chris did all the heavy lifting on that.
Now, some of the pieces are from magazines. Some are introductions that you've written for probably new editions of older books, for the most part, I'm guessing. And but some of them were unpublished.
Well, some of the books I was writing about, you mean, or some of the
some of the essays, or if they
Yeah, well, there's three or four things in here that are new writing, where some part of what, you know, once Chris had put the book together and placed the pieces in conjunction, I realized, oh, this deserves a kind of an update of some kind. So I wrote a little, what I called a footnote, to I think it's three or four of the pieces, explaining, kind of bringing them up to date, explaining how my thinking has changed on that subject, or, you know, in a couple of cases they have to do with my actual relationships with the writers in question, sort of reminiscences about my contact with, for instance, Thomas Berger, which had grown and changed in a very interesting way after the last piece I'd written about him. And so I included these extra bits to bring the book up to date, but also put a little something new in it so that...
Well, I was curious how Chris found those, or so you actually wrote them for the book.
I wrote those additional pieces to flesh out the book, absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
Now, Jonathan, you also teach writing.
I do. I'm a creative writing instructor at Pomona College, where I teach undergraduates, very talented and lovely ones, in fiction workshops. You know, mostly as fiction workshops tend to be, mostly devoted to looking at their short story drafts and attempts. Sometimes I've got someone who's ambitious enough to already be writing a novel in their undergraduate life, and we'll look at chapters, portions of the novel.
And where is Pomona?
Southern California. It's on the eastern edge of Los Angeles.
Okay. And you replaced someone fairly well known in your position.
Yes, the job I have, the very lucky and kind of celebrated position, is called the Roy Disney Chair in Creative Writing. And it was created, about 15 years ago now. It was endowed by Roy Disney, who was Walt Disney's brother, who was also a Pomona alum. And it was specifically designed to bring a fiction writer, a literary writer, to Pomona College. Mm-hmm. And the first person who occupied the Disney chair was David Foster Wallace, who, you know, had a very, very great commitment to teaching and was, I think, an extraordinary teacher by all accounts, and left a very large footprint in this, you know, in this community here at the college. So after he died, you know, they took a little time. I think it was probably actually very very challenging to contemplate having another Disney chair, and so they let some years pass, and then eventually it was offered to me, which was just a piece of, well, great luck, life-changing luck for me, and it put me in an interesting kind of oblique but interesting relationship to Wallace and his legacy, because here I was, you know, in a kind of a symbolic sense, sitting in his office and trying to extend his work here in this community, which well, it ended up meaning a lot to me, and it actually drew me closer to his writing than I'd felt previously. I spent time talking with a lot of students who had a very powerful relationship to him. I think his presence here had drawn a number of students who cared immensely about his work, and that it, in turn, that sort of made me care more about his work than I had before. So it's been an interesting legacy for me.
Wow. Had you taught before this?
Yeah, I was a teacher sporadically, mostly in MFA programs. I'd been, over the years, I'd been asked to be a visiting writer, you know, or what they call a distinguished visitor at a bunch of really great places. NYU most recently, that was the work I was doing in the time just before they pulled me out here to California. I was teaching at the MFA program at NYU, which I liked very much. And other times I'd been at Columbia University and a scattering of other places where I'd been sort of made guest appearances. But the job of being a visiting writer is really different from taking on an actual position and being a member of a faculty. So in a way, I was familiar with the classroom, the creative writing classroom, but I wasn't really a professor before then. I didn't know what it was to work as a colleague in an English department and so forth. So this is a change in that way.
Now, do you feel like it distracts from your... I mean, obviously it takes time, so it leaves you less time to write, but are there other compensating factors that make you more productive as a writer?
Well, you know, the thing about writing is no one does it in a vacuum. There's this sort of fantasy, this is a very attractive fantasy in some ways, of just clearing out your schedule, just having nothing else in front of you and only writing, which, you know, on certain very exotic occasions at a writer's colony, or when I was a bit younger and if I arranged my life just right, I could maybe play around with that occasionally. And sometimes that's great, although actually having a giant desert of time in front of you isn't always the best way to write. It's actually sometimes better to have a slightly more structured life and have the writing, you know, occupy one part of a schedule where it pushes up against other things and where your life has some definition to it. But the fact is, most of the time, whether it was because I needed to, you know, make a living or just because I'd become interested in doing other things or, you know, I was invited into some exciting opportunity or situation, my writing is usually kind of competing with or jostling against other tasks, whether it's journalism or teaching. You know, a couple of times I've acted as a screenwriter. You know, and then there's just life itself, having friends, having a relationship, having children. So the writing is always pushing against other things, and I think that's sort of natural and just as well. When I came out here, the truth is the biggest challenge my writing had ever encountered was just then overtaking me, and that was that I'd had kids. Really much, much harder thing to balance against writing life than teaching. So I don't really see the teaching as a problem in that way. And it does, you know, as you suggested in your question, it does nourish the work in subtle ways. I mean, you know, I can be as curmudgeonly as any other college professor you'd ever meet about the day when I'm facing like a stack of papers to grade or have to sit and do my office hours. But the actual encounter, the classroom experience, the time spent with aspiring writers, pretty much always throws me into a really extraordinary understanding of myself and my own relationship to writing and my own commitment to it. You know, working with writers who are just figuring some of those things out makes me re-encounter those parts of myself and having to articulate what I think about, you know, this extremely amorphous task of making stories that someone else would actually want to read. It makes me think about what I know and figure out what I know in a really desirable way. So the teaching itself does really nourish my writing and change it in interesting ways.
In your writing technique, do you formulate with an outline, or how do you go about it?
I'm not a great outliner I've never really written full plan or plot or outline for what I'm going to do. I take notes as parts of the story occur to me out of sequence, you know, ideas, set pieces, thoughts I have about how the story should develop. I'll jot things down on Post-its and stick them up around my office. But I do also really treasure the sense of exploration, learning the story, you know, in a way, almost the way the reader does, by uncovering it moment by moment. And, you know, I find that in order to begin a book, I have to have a lot of inklings about the feeling and the situation at the end. I need some sort of image of a destination.
Okay, that was my next question. Yeah,
but a lot of what I will encounter along the way to that destination is more or less a day to day act of discovery and improvisation.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of the essays in More Alive and Less Lonely are essentially book reviews, and I'm guessing that if you wrote a negative review, it probably wouldn't have made its way into this book.
Well, I've barely ever done it. I think that it's, without wanting to seem like some sort of Pollyanna or just a cheerleader for literature, there are plenty of books that don't suit me or that I'm irritated with or impatient with, don't finish, or preemptively just, I can see him coming, and I
and you duck
the street.
Yeah.
But I personally, it's not that I don't think there are books that would elicit a negative review from me, but I just have chosen not to put myself into that life situation any more than is absolutely necessary. I mean, I won't say who it is because it feels ungraceful. But there's a skeptical review. There's a review, a disappointed review in this book. And, there might even be a couple. But those are disappointed reviews of books by authors that I admire whole. And that's to say, I just really don't dig reading something that I expect not to like and that I'm setting myself against in some native way. I don't see my job as being the one who sorts out what's overrated or overvalued. I've never thought that was a very interesting or urgent kind of cultural work to do. And so, and personally, psychically, I'm just not really keen on spending a lot of my time denouncing stuff.
Yeah.
So I have sidestepped that kind of occasion. you know, if you were a daily or a weekly reviewer and your job was to, implicitly, was to be the one who did the thumbs up and the thumbs down on all sorts of books that were being hyped really enormously, and you thought, it's not all that, then I guess that would be your job, and you'd have to have an appetite for doing that. But I've never taken that job. I've never been anyone's staff reviewer or had any kind of regular perch where I was, you know, the arbiter.
Well, how do you get these reviews placed for publication? Does a publication approach you to review a specific book, or do you have a book you just want to write about and then you pitch it to different publications?
I've actually never pitched a review per se. I think that most of the places that I would want to see a review of mine appear in are kind of allergic to that.
Mm.
Sort of figure if you're pitching that you ought to review something, they get skeptical. That might somehow be unseemly. They want the appearance of a kind of objective assignment. So what happens instead? I mean, the thing for me is I didn't start reviewing books until I'd already published three or four novels, and so I began to be a name that people wanted to see appear in their magazine, and so I would get these invitations, and increasingly I got them, and so I would wait for the ones that made sense to me, that seemed that seemed promising. The introductions to books are a different case. I mean, in some cases, those came to me, but in other cases, I did propose something, and you know, there are some instances in this book of introductions I got to write to books that were being republished because I'd suggested to the publisher that they ought to be republished.
Oh, wow.
So in that case, I'm acting more as a kind of curator, you know, advocate for something that's been forgotten or you know, kind of underrated, undervalued, and needs to be celebrated.
What would be an example of one of those in the book?
Well, I mean, I know that when I wrote about books for the New York Review of Books, for instance, there's a review of On the Yard by Malcolm Brawley. That's an entire publishing line that's devoted to rescuing obscurities, rescuing books that have been forgotten. And I've had their ear. I've been very lucky to have their ear over the years, and so with Malcolm Brawley and with Don Carpenter, who I didn't actually write about, but who I did help sort of propose him to be republished, and a number of other people, I've been one of the, you know, in a sense, part of a kind of a loose, informal editorial board for the New York Review of Books, helping to point out books that they might want to republish. When you see something like a review of Kazuo Ishiguro's new book or Laurie Moore's new book, that's a very different situation. That's the New York Times or Book Forum coming to me and saying, we've got the galleys, we're looking to assign this review, and would you be interested? And then, you know, I'll just pick and choose my occasions on those.
I would imagine that certain times, depending on the culture of the time, some books are overlooked and are really great books, but they're overlooked because of the culture, and people aren't interested in that particular thing.
Yeah, so, yeah, there are things that come in and out of fashion,
uh-huh.
And also there's just the great, you know, tremendously unfair, but you know, at least universal roulette wheel of life. A lot of things just never get their shot. You know,
yeah.
they're published in an unlucky way, or they're published inexpertly, or no one notices.
Yeah,
right.
And so there's lots of deserving stuff that people would love to read that is sort of lying in wait, that, you know, never had its moment or barely had a moment or did have a moment, but you know, it was 30, 40 years ago, and it's been forgotten, and then someone looks at it. I mean, that's the great Ezra Pound line is, I think it's Pound, literature is news that stays news.
Mm. And then,
great
too,
line.
Too, there's so much.
Beautiful and effective. carries this lasting value. But we live in a culture of news and of the idea of the contemporary. There's a great obsession with, you know,
immediacy.
It's been released. And so the rate of turnover can sometimes be devastatingly rapid for very good books that just are quieter or just take some time to find their audience.
Not sensational and not, And, of course, the news, I mean, the social media has changed the whole atmosphere.
Well, you see that acceleration is even more extraordinary with social media. I mean, I think it's terrifyingly the case that modern publishing regards books as having something like a two-week window in which to, you know, catch.
Oh my goodness!
Catch the interest of the public, and you know what used to happen when I even when I was starting out, and the you know my first novel was published in '94. There were dozens more review venues, you know, so many more newspapers that had a book page. But an even more striking difference between then and now was that the reviews wouldn't necessarily all happen on the day of publication. You might see a review still pop up 2-3 months after a book was published as people, you know, turn their attention to it. And so the window in which a book was regarded as contemporary and brand new was a much wider window. Now, because of the internet and the desire to always be the first hit, the first linked, the first mention of something, every, you know, when I publish a novel, pretty much every review it's going to get has emerged within the first 72 hours.
Oh, wow.
It's a star acceleration.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jonathan Lethem, author of More Alive and Less Lonely, on books and writers.
So if a reader misses that 72, those first reviews, then your book, they never, you know, it passes out of their purview, so to speak.
Well, yes, unless, of course, the wonderful thing happens, which is the heart of all of this, is readers passing books one to the next.
Uh-huh.
Whether they're booksellers or librarians or someone like you on the radio or someone like me in an essay saying, hey, you know, hey, you got to read this.
Yeah.
And that's the best of all.
Yeah.
That's the thing that no publicist could ever control or quantify, nor would we want them to be able to, which is that the real way that most of us come to books is by an intimate recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who really...
Someone you know and trust.
...tells you that you've, you know, forget what you've heard or forget that you haven't heard anything. This is a book you would love.
Yeah, right.
Well, what do you see as the future of publishing? I mean, you've obviously seen a lot of changes since you started publishing. A lot of consolidation in the large mainstream press, a lot of small presses going by the wayside, the rise of self-publishing. What has impacted you the most, and what do you see in the future?
Well, I'm not a guru of publishing by any measure, and I only have my own kind of very peculiar and, you know, I'm stuck inside my own experience. There's no doubt that the biggest change in that experience in the time since I began is the onset of the internet and the rise of the, for better and worse, I think there are very good and very troubling things about it, the rise of the sort of upvote, downvote culture, you know, Amazon reviews and Goodreads and this sort of authorizing of every single reader as the reviewer of a book. It's very interesting, and it's a way of kind of bringing what I just described to you, the individual or intimate recommendation, to the foreground. But it also, it can be quite, there can be a kind of a superficiality to it. It itself has become very instantaneous and monetized, and it's turned into a kind of a, you know, it's almost like readerly recommendations have been turned into a kind of video game or sport. But, you know, the internet, despite all of the kind of doomsaying, and you know, there are ominous things about the changes it's imposed in our collective experience in all sorts of ways, it is a reading medium. It's a place where people go to write and read, and there's a tremendous amount of talk about books. And I don't think that it has, it may have changed the financial frameworks, and it certainly had a devastating effect on booksellers. But in terms of literacy, in terms of the value of what I do, I'm not sure that it's had such a simply, threatening result. In many ways, you know, we live in a culture that's obsessed with the written word. And I may be sometimes terrified by the velocity and the particular flavor of, what happens to text, what happens to the literary conversation when it enters into that realm of velocity. But I don't think what I do is going anywhere.
Well, it's true. The internet's hungry for content.
Absolutely. And also, in some ways, the bewildering nature of contemporary life, which the internet exemplifies, or anyway is a giant window into, it makes you deeply, deeply hungry for the opposite, which is the kind of centered, concentrated, extended experience of thinking, mm-hmm. feeling that literature represents. The timelessness of a book and the intimacy of the communion between one reader's mind and one writer's mind, and the duration, the way a book that really absorbs you sort of stops time, stops it cold, and just puts you into another framework. I think these are things that make books increasingly crucial to us.
Well, I would agree with that. Jonathan, before we run out of time, would you like to read from one of the essays in the book?
Oh, sure. You know, I've got a funny one that I'll try on you that's, I think I can have time enough to read it complete because it's very short. And
great.
It's an essay called Books Are Sandwiches. Chris Boucher had the cleverness to put as the very last selection. So here goes. Books are sandwiches. Books are sandwiches. Between their bready boards lies a filling of information-dense leaves nestled together, an accumulation of layers for cumulative effect. Ratio is everything. Proportion. Too many slices of either meat or cheese can wreck a sandwich's middle passages, the overused fundamental, creating a bricky, discursive dry spot in what ought to have been a moist sequence. Too much aioli or chutney or roasted red pepper, always use those soaked in olive oil, never water, can gush, drench bread, run down the hand, and destroy a wristwatch. Yet other sandwiches, the tours de force, thrive on excess, disunity, a pepperoncini or cherry tomato bursting through the door like a character with a gun in his hand, a rant of watercress or filibuster of brie, an unexpected chapter of flaked oregano inserted like a flashback or dream in italics. We dislike instinctively those who turn a sandwich and gnaw vertically against the grain, wrecking the spine and architecture of a sandwich. Their disregard for narrative sequence is as violent as spoiling the plot of a book by gossiping in advance of the outcome. In each sandwich inheres an intrinsic eating speed, shameful to violate. Eating more and understanding less? Slow down. Hors d'oeuvres on tiny crackers are poems, always seeking perfection in elusive gestures, annoying to try to make a meal of. Hot dogs, ice cream sandwiches, and Oreo cookies are like children's picture books, bright and goonish, drawing the eater's eye like a magpie's to something glinting, the clowns of sandwiches. Hamburgers are clowns, too, anonymous clowns that pile out of cars, frequently dwarves. Despite the propensity to make hamburgers even bigger, to boast of ounces, the default hamburger is a White Castle. As Wimpy knows, burgers are eaten in cereal, like mystery novels, I always on the last page and the burger to follow. Sandwiches are too often served in public. In fact, the reader of sandwiches is essentially engaged in a private act and becomes steadily irritable at our scrutiny. The Earl of Sandwich may have been a pool player, but the reader of sandwiches has no time for us or the ringing telephone, and only one hand free for a book.
There you go.
And that was Jonathan Lethem reading from his collection of essays, More Alive and Less Lonely, on books and writers. And this was published in the Book Club Cookbook in 2004.
That's right.
What was the Book Club Cookbook?
You know, you do these things, people ask you to submit to these things. I don't even know if I was ever even sent a copy of the Book Club Cookbook. I have no idea. If I was, I dropped it into one of my archival boxes and forgot about it. So I don't know what the rest of the contents of that might be. But I suppose it's probably a bunch of recipes by authors.
Ah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Tell me a little bit more about, you'd mentioned the On the Yard.
Yes.
Tell us a little more about that.
That is a marvelous book. I think it's, in my personal opinion, it's the greatest novel of prison life in American literature. It was written by a guy named Malcolm Brawley, who was himself a career criminal as a teenager and in his 20s, and was incarcerated at San Quentin for breaking and entering and other kinds of criminal activity, and became a writer while he was behind bars. So it's a remarkable story, and also attests to a really interesting time in the history of American prisons, when there were many incarcerated writers, because for a little while the act of writing was being encouraged by wardens, and mm-hmm. and at San Quentin in particular. I think when Malcolm Brawley was in prison in San Quentin, there were three other published novelists inside with him at the time, all of whom had become novelists while.
Wow, and I know there's very little encouragement for that type of thing in prisons now, in our prison systems.
I think it's
now.
Very rare.
Yeah.
The writing materials are often confiscated, in fact. I think it's rather tragic, but that's a whole other story.
I had noted this one in the last paragraph of the essay about On the Yard, where you wrote that Malcolm Brawley's peak as a writer came in the two complimentary books, the novel and the memoir. And in the memoir, he says about the novel, "I was writing over my head."
Yeah, I love that the humbleness of that remark, and also it's a humble brag. I think that's what they call it these days, because he was, I think, you know, in a sense, and we all are at our best writing something that we can't quite believe we're capable of. I've experienced that feeling, I don't know, three or four times in my decades of devoting myself to this practice, and it's, you know, it's what you're there for, are those great moments when you feel that you know, something in you that is more than you know craft can get you to, and it's speaking through you, and it's both very it's a very humbling moment and a very brash one at the same time, when you look at a page and you say, wow.
And sometimes, you know, particularly if you're an unpublished writer and you've been doing it for a long time, you might pull out something that you wrote, you don't even remember writing, and you look at it and say, wow, I did that?
Yeah. It's what you live for, because, of course, the opposite experience is unfortunately going to be the default mode is, you know, you're excited when you're writing something, and then you look at it and it's not there, or it's not quite right, or it needs some fixing.
Yeah,
only good enough. But yeah, you stay in this game long enough, and you will have those transcendent times when you are writing above your head.
Or in my case, there was a time when I found a book of handwritten poems from my teen, you know, from when I was a teenager, and I'm looking at them, and there was one I think, wow, this is really, really good. And then I realized at some point that it wasn't a poem I'd written. It was the lyrics to a Jim Croce song.
You'd copied it out.
Yep.
Well, that can happen.
So do you edit your own work, or do you have someone that you work with that edits for you?
Well, I'm a careful reviser, which is different from editing, because no one can finally edit their own work. You can only revise it from the inside as the author, and so you do depend on a good editor and then a good copy editor to give it that look from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Every piece of writing needs
editing. Absolutely.
I put on it at some point.
Yeah.
And I rely on, I'm very fortunate, the editor I've worked with at my publisher, Doubleday, my principal publisher, has been, he's been a very dedicated editor, page by page, book by book, but he's also been a very forgiving and generous one, because I've tried a lot of different kinds of writing over the years, and he seems to be willing to go with me, you know, wherever I want to go, which is, you know, it's not a given. Someone might like just one
right.
book you wrote and
right.
And not all the rest. So,
well, Jonathan, you know, this collection, More Alive and Less Lonely, is sectioned into 8 different sections. Can you tell us a little bit about the structure and how that came about? Did you have input into that, or was that entirely Chris?
This is where you're really looking at Chris's labors, and I think it's a very elegant design. You know, there are some obvious gatherings of the essays. Chapter or section 6, which is about Ishiguro and Thomas Berger and Philip K. Dick. These are 3 writers with whom I have a very extensive kind of lifelong devotion. I've read them for as long as as long as I've been a reader, and they, in the case of Berger and Ishiguro, both became personal relationships for me. And so Chris saw the similarity in the 3, my relationship to those 3 writers, and thought, oh, these speak to one another. These will go together very naturally. And there are some other ways in which he's clustered the book to bring out similarities in certain areas of my work. I'm really, really very lucky that I did hand this project over to him, because he instilled it with a kind of thoughtfulness that it just wouldn't have been available to me to look at the essays in this particular way.
Well, give us a brief summary of what each of the sections, like Engulf and Devour.
Yes, right. So Engulf and Devour refers to my interest, which is a continuing one, on the way you can lose yourself in your relation to an author, the way someone can seem so extraordinary or so relevant to you that you've become obsessed. And so I talk about, for instance, how Kafka is a a consuming fascination. You know, I mean, so many books have been written about Kafka, and so many, even just biographies. He's almost got countless numbers of biographies. He's a writer who tends to inspire that kind of devotion. And I also write here about Dickens and about Philip Roth, writers who you could, you know, devote your whole life to just thinking about their work.
And, of course, Moby Dick is in here.
And Moby Dick is in there, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, then for another instance, Section 4, Lost Worlds, is the one that includes On the Yard, Malcolm Brawley's prison novel. And this is really about writers who almost no one will have heard of.
Mm.
They're real cult objects who I've become fascinated with, and I'm basically trying to put up a big neon billboard saying, more attention is deserved, you know? Somebody coming this out. It's really great. So it's really about me as the kind of advocate for these marginal figures.
So those are the ones, if we've never heard of, we really shouldn't feel bad.
You shouldn't feel bad.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, Caroline was an English teacher, a high school English teacher, so.
But I never heard of some of these.
Yep.
And, you know, or I won't do every single section, but I'll skip around here
sure.
on a chapter, section 8, fan mail, the one that includes books or sandwiches, which I read aloud for you, is really about my my position as a reader and a fan, someone who's still, you know, despite, you know, being middle-aged and having published a bunch of novels, I still kind of get, you know, I get excited if I get to meet one of my heroes. So it's about, like, what it's like for me to go up to Anthony Burgess and ask him for an autograph in one of his books.
And how is it when you're in the other shoe, you know, when you're in the other position and fans?
I'll never be done marveling at the luck I've had to live this life and have people come up to me and say, for instance, want me to autograph one of their books. And I try to be extremely remain grateful and humble, because it's such an extraordinary relationship to have readers at all. You know, I don't take it for granted. it involved a lot of persistence on my part and to get into this situation, but I also know that it involves a lot of luck. There are many people who write books who haven't enjoyed the kinds of opportunities I've had, and or haven't been published. You know, well, my book is full of examples of people who weren't published as well as I have been.
So how can a reader find this book?
Well, I hope it's in all kinds of bookstores, ideally filling up their window and front tables.
Yeah.
As with everything else, it could be
online,
located on various internet buying sites like Powell's or Amazon.
Right, but we do like to support our local bookstores.
And if you've got a local bookstore, by all means, go in and demand copy for you. They can do that.
Well, Jonathan, final word. If someone is new to your writing, what of your novels, which one would you recommend they start with?
Well, that's a great question. I think that time has shown me that Motherless Brooklyn has been, for more people than not, it has been the gateway drug. Probably is still my most beguiling book, my funniest and most endearing. So maybe that's a good answer to your question.
That sounds like a great answer.
On different days, I have different favorites.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Jonathan.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk.
Jonathan Latham, More Alive and Less Lonely, on Books and Writers, wherever books are sold. Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
I do. A gentleman named Paulo Coelho said, "Writing means sharing. It's part of the human condition to want to share things, thoughts, ideas, and opinions." Amen.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. Look forward to many more books from you.
Thanks so much.
And if you're listening on Friday, stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. If you're listening on Monday morning, have a great day, and we'll see you next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.